In the 2020th of films, Netflix's The Midnight Sky tells the story of a world in chaos at the hands of a mysterious pandemic. Left alone in an Arctic research station, scientist Augustine races to contact a crew of astronauts returning home to warn them of the dangers that await them. In our first episode of 2021, Seeing and Believing's Wade Bearden stops by to talk to us about connecting across the vast reaches of space, what it means to be the right person, and our top three movie moments of 2020. Yes, there were movies in 2020. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome back to the podcast and to 2021. We are so thrilled to be here as we kick off a new year. It is just nice to kick off a new year. Forget the podcast for a minute.
Yeah, sometimes I'm sad. I'm like, oh, that was a really good year. I get all nostalgic. And now I'm like, yes, I can't wait. I didn't even stay up and finish out 2020. I went to bed.
me neither. I was just like, it's fine. 2020 was a great decade. I needed to get out of that. We are glad that you're here with us today on Screenfish Radio as we talk about The Midnight Sky, the latest Netflix film, and this one directed by George Clooney. But first of all, I would love to welcome back Wade Bearden from Seeing and Believing to the show. Welcome back, Wade.
Hey, thanks, Steve. I'm excited to be on the podcast with you. It's been a little while. I think it's been a few months because we did our comfort foods.
Yes.
And that was, I guess maybe it felt like a couple years ago. It was like mid-2020. So it's good to be on again.
Mid-2020, It may have only been months, but it really truly does feel like it's been an extremely long time. I'm so glad that we could do this again. Now, Wade, I know we're supposed to talk about Midnight Sky, but before we do that, I know this is the first time you've been on the first one of a year, and we have a bit of a tradition that I'd like to keep going with you, if that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't chugged hot sauce, a bottle of hot sauce in a while, but if that's the tradition.
Well, you can do that on your end. If you need that tonic to get through the night, that's totally fine. I know Kevin just had a baby. And so, first of all, shout out to Kevin for him and his wife. Congratulations. But what we've been doing the last couple of years is our top movie moments of the year, not just our top films. The one thing about movie moments that I think is unique is that it can be a film that may not be in your top 10 films of the year, but there can be those moments that just sort of hit you or are just full of joy or that are really memorable. So I was hoping that we could do that, maybe our top three movie moments of 2020, because they did exist. Movies did exist in 2020.
They did. They happened.
The lines have blurred substantially over the year, but they absolutely did. So maybe an honorable mention in our top three movie moments of the year, if that's all right with you.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a moment that didn't quite hit the top three, but it's just so good that it could have been one, two, or three. And I'm talking about a scene from Kirsten Johnson's Dick Johnson is Dead. This is a documentary where filmmaker Kirsten Johnson actually stages her father's death before he actually dies and walks through the grieving process before she actually has to grieve his death. It's a beautiful picture, a fun picture. Her father, Dr. Dick Johnson, is a great sport. One great movie scene of the year is at the beginning of the film. He's walking down the street, and an AC unit falls from the sky and crushes him. And that's just – somebody's like, well, how's that a great moment? And these are just various scenes that they put together to consider or envision how someone like him could possibly die. And it's very, very funny. But there comes a scene towards the back half of the picture, and Johnson's father has moved across the country to New York City, and she is taking care of him. He's beginning to suffer from dementia, and she's essentially made this commitment that she's going to take care of him for the rest of her life. And they go out with her – I believe she just has one son. They go out trick-or-treating, and the film cuts – to Dick Johnson, and this is a reenactment, of course, and he's in this sort of almost like a horror house. He's watching television, and he gets up, of course, very confused, and he begins to look around and find his bearings in this haunted house. And the scene eventually cuts, and we find out the reason that Johnson actually put that scene together is because while they were trick-or-treating, he'd begun to get confused, so they actually dropped him off and set him in front of a TV at a friend's house in her apartment so he could just kind of relax and not be out there among all the people. And while he was watching TV, he became very, very confused, disoriented. And so Johnson in this scene is seeking to visualize how he must have felt in that moment. And it's a jarring scene that puts you into his shoes. And she comes back after all of this and comforts her father and begins to kind of rethink how she'll care for him. It's a devastating scene. It's an imaginative scene, but ultimately it's a fantastic example of empathy and even her love for her father. So, yeah, that's my honorable mention at number four, but honorable mention.
Yeah, you know, honestly, one of the things I love about these conversations is that there are so many films that are mentioned that I have not seen, and Dick Johnson is Dead is one of them that I've heard nothing but good things about. But even like it's only recently that I found out that it was like a pre-eulogy. And I hear that it's just so funny and creative and unique.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And what's fascinating is her father is a Seventh-day Adventist. At one point in the movie, and this is another great scene from the year, she visualizes how it might feel when he gets to heaven and is reunited with his deceased wife, Kirsten Johnson's mother. And it's not meant to be literal. It's kind of this zany scene, but it's fun and it's joyful and there's confetti. And she's very respectful of her father's beliefs and attempting to tap into the hope that he has for the afterlife. It's an amazing scene and a very, very good movie.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to checking that one out. That is one that I haven't seen yet and I hear is great. My honorable mention, I'm not sure if I would call it my number four or not, but it gave me great joy. It's a little different than what you said there, and I'm not going to tip my hat quite yet, but I admit that the scene is actually from the film we're talking about today, is from Midnight Sky. Without saying quite yet what I thought of the film overall, there is this scene where these astronauts in space have to make a repair on the outside of the ship, and of course, because in every space film, they have to take a spacewalk to make a repair on the outside of the ship. But
it has to be done.
It has to be done. Like, check the outside of the ship before you go, guys.
get a robot to do this.
Exactly. The Canadarm. No. But they go out for this spacewalk, and there are these three astronauts out there in the loneliness of space. And as they're making this repair, one of them says to one of the crew members on the inside, "Can you play us some music?" And he says, "I know what you need to hear." And they play "Sweet Caroline" by Neil Diamond.
Yep.
And it's this silly, it's a silly scene in some ways, but I mean, let's be honest, like whether or not you like the song, it's an infectious song.
Oh yeah.
And there's this joy in this moment, which I think brings the ideas and the themes of the film to life. And I'll be honest, it's one of those few times this year watching a film that I just felt joy. Like it was a truly infectious moment. I found myself singing along and it just sort of brings you in at the same time. And that's why I felt like I had to include it as a moment on my list.
Yeah, yeah. It's a fun moment in the film. And that song, like you said, whether you like it or not, it's infectious. And I don't know if I can use this word, but I'll go ahead and use it in our post-COVID world. It's contagious. And when it comes on, everybody sings it. It's a fun scene.
Well, and in a post-COVID world, a song where you start singing hands, touching me, touching you.
Just,
there is that element to it. But well, again, but so, I mean, that was a film, or that was a moment that I thought, you know what, it had to be on my list in some ways. Well, but let's get to our top three, Wade. What's your number three?
Yeah, so my number three is actually from my favorite film of the year. And Steve, I talked to you about this film on the Seeing and Believing podcast. It's from Nomadland, and it's directed by Chloe Zhao. This new film from the writers Chloe Zhao, Nomadland, stars Frances McDormand as Fern, a widow who leaves her defunct small town to traverse the American West. We see her move across the country, form relationships, and really process her grief. She originally left her Nevada home because essentially she lived in a company town, and when that company shut down, it became a ghost town. And she leaves it behind. We learn that her husband passed away while they were living in that home. Towards the end of the movie, she comes back during the Nevada winter. And she stops by at her old home, and she begins to walk through those spaces, those rooms. And at one point, she walks outside of the house, and Chloe Zhao frames the shot from inside looking outside, and we see her silhouetted figure. And my co-host, Kevin McLenathan, he pointed out that there is much in common with that shot as the famous John Ford shot in The Searchers with John Wayne. And in that film, John Wayne, he kind of walks out of this cabin, this house. We see his silhouette. And at that point, he becomes this figure in American history, this certain type of individual. As the world is kind of moving on, he's standing still. And we get that here, that Frances McDormand is or represents a certain type of individual that we've often left behind as they're standing still. It's a fantastic scene. And you know what? Good movies, they find a way to put you in the shoes of someone else. Great movies put you in the shoes of someone else in a different environment than you're used to, while simultaneously tapping in to a universal quality or idea or theme that you understand. And so that's what this film does. I get to see the world from her perspective as she goes throughout this house, this empty home. And at the same time, though, it taps into this longing for home and even this tangible sense of spaces, sacred spaces within our own lives. And I moved during the summer, and I really enjoy the house I'm at now. I don't necessarily miss my old house per se, But thinking about that house, and even when I've driven past that house a couple of times since we moved, there's so many memories there. And those memories say so much about who we are and the people we've become. And I think all of that's kind of encapsulated in this scene. And it's a really wonderful scene.
Well, you know, I agree with you 100%. This is a wonderful film. And I know it's getting its wide release next month, but it is, I would say it's probably, I think it's my pick for best film of the year, to be honest. And there are so many moments in this one, in that particular film, that they actually almost canceled each other out for me. That's why, for some reason, it's not on there. But that's not because I didn't think it was great. That movie is so great in so many different ways. And the way you describe that moment is just stunning, because it is... It's a moment of sadness and joy and peace, and I don't know if frustration is there, but it's all encapsulated. It's such a complex moment. It's wordless. Nothing is said. There's no grand speech. It's just her in her home, and it's a really stunning moment. So that's a great pick.
Yeah, I love what you say. There's so many emotions within that scene. You get the sense that she is moving on, but there's still deep sadness about the past. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's really put together extremely well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My top three, or my number three moment, is quite different. It's from a documentary called 76 Days, which I don't know if you've seen, Wade, but 76 Days is a documentary that came out in September, and it focuses on the 76-day lockdown in Wuhan at the start of the virus. It's really remarkable this film came together in this way, considering it came in just about 3 or 4 months after it ended, this lockout ended. And it takes place mostly in the hospital where the outbreaks were located. And it simply follows the frontline workers and what they had to deal with. And one of the opening scenes of this film is, I kid you not, something that is truly out of a zombie movie. It's not sensationalized, but it is countless people literally beating down the door to get into the hospital while the several doctors are standing there trying to make sense of what's going on. And these are people who have varying degrees of illness. They don't understand it so early in the pandemic. And it is this wild moment of just pure chaos that shows the courage of the people that were involved in the front line and just the terror of the moment. And it's a documentary. Like I said, this is not sensationalized. This is not a dramatic representation. It's not thrown together. It's footage. And that's my number three moment.
Well, yeah, I have not seen that documentary, and I'm glad that you talked about it and you recommend it, because the idea of a documentary coming out when we're still in the middle of the pandemic, it just wasn't appealing to me, because I'm thinking to myself, we still don't know where we're going. There's still a lot more left. But the fact that it does focus on a particular place and really the origin of where all of this kind of started, and we get to see everything happening there. And I do need to check it out. I'll probably do it when I can watch something very happy afterwards, but it does appeal to me.
Well, you know, one of the things I will say is when I popped it in, my instinct was to actually think that they were going to try and offer some answers or cobble together or blame, and they really don't. That's one of the things I appreciate about the film. Wow. This isn't a film that tries to figure out the answers. It's just a fly on the wall of a moment in history and says, this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really appreciated about that moment in that film.
Oh. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I have to watch that. So my number two pick is from a film by Andrew Ahn. It's called Driveways. And I know that some people listening to this might not know what this movie is about, so I have the official synopsis here. I'll go ahead and read it. 8-year-old Cody, played by Lucas J., is spending the summer in an unfamiliar setting with his mom, Kathy. Though he can't relate to the neighborhood kids, things take an unexpected turn when he develops an unusual friendship with grouchy old Dell, played by Brian Dennehy, from Next Door. Now, when you hear that synopsis, it feels pretty cliche. This movie, though, branches out into a number of themes, a number of ideas and topics, from unlikely friendships to what it means to grow old and what it means to discover something about a loved one that you did not know. Cody's family, him and his mother, they move into her deceased sister's home, and it's in terrible shape. She has clutter every single in every place. She's a hoarder, and they didn't know that about her. They didn't realize that she was living this way, and there's a lot of regret there. The film ends on a speech from Brian Dennehy. Brian Dennehy is one of those actors that most people know if they see a picture of him. He's played in a number of movies, you know, as far back as something like First Blood and Silverado and Cocoon. And he recently passed away. This is one of his last films. And he gives this incredible speech to young Cody. And he talks about a number of different events in his life. He talks about what he wishes he'd known years ago. There's this just power there from a seasoned performer. And as Cody is listening to this conversation, you get the sense that this is one of those moments that he'll remember. Even though he's only eight, he'll remember for the rest of his life. And it reminds me of conversations that I've had with people where they've either dispensed wisdom directly or indirectly, or talked about their life, shared their regrets, that I'll remember for the rest of my life. It's an incredible, incredible scene. And if your listeners have not had a chance to check out Driveways, it's a really tender, beautiful film. Made my top 10, and one of my favorite scenes of the year is just the final five minutes. I mean, it's one of those you're going to rewind and watch again.
That's one that I'm definitely going to have to check out, because that is, I'm actually excited to hear that. Like, he's one of those guys that when he's in a film, he brings a weight to his characters, no matter what he's playing, that I appreciate. So but it's been so long since I've heard of Brian Dennehy's name mentioned in anything. So I'm going to have to take a look at that. Is that a more recent film in 2020, or is that one of the earlier ones? Do you remember?
Yeah. So I actually saw this in April or May.
Okay.
And there's, in the States, for any of your listeners who are in the States, there's this website called Hoopla, and it connects to your local library. So if you have a library card, you can go to Hoopla, and you can put it in, and you'll actually be able to check out books digitally and sometimes even watch movies digitally. And Driveways is on there. And I didn't even think about watching it until I heard that Brian Dennehy had passed away. And so I was like, okay, well, let's just check this out. And yeah, just a really great picture. So there are ways to see it. If you don't have Hoopla, you can always rent it. But yeah, it's one of those that flew under the radar. He should get a nomination for this, but I think the movie is so underseen, he just won't.
Right. That could be. My number two is, again, from another actor who is no longer with us, and that is Chadwick Boseman's speech about his new shoes in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Most people think of Chadwick Boseman now, and they think of him probably as Black Panther. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, here was a guy who was dying and told very few people. He had a very close inner circle, so it was quite a shock when he passed away. This being his last role, there's something certainly special about it, but that's not why I mention it. There is an energy in his performance, both him and Viola Davis, that I think really lifts the film up in incredible ways. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, this is on Netflix. It's the second film under the contract of the production company by Denzel Washington after Fences. It's another. It's actually the same author, I believe. I could be wrong on that, but I believe it's the same author. And it's a play that tells the story of... It takes place in the 1940s, and it tells the story of one afternoon trying to record one song by this superstar singer, Ma Rainey, and what happens between her and her band. And Chadwick Boseman plays this trumpet player who is new and fresh and has all these ideas about the way the world should work. And he is constantly told by the older African-American gentleman that that's just not how it is. But he has this vitality and this energy. And so much of those conversations is highlighted and centered around his new pair of shoes at the beginning of the film. And there's this exciting banter in that moment that I think certainly speaks to many of the conversations that are taking place right now, but also just show this tension between youthful hopefulness and more of an older, not wisdom is not the word, but an older understanding of how things have been in the past, that are nervous about new ideas and new perspectives. And it's so much centered around his performance that I felt like, to me, that was such a significant moment for this year.
Yeah, and it was very difficult when you mentioned, hey, there are three that we're going to do, and you have an extra honorable mention because there's some scenes from Soul I would like to include, yeah. And there's another scene from this movie. You mentioned one scene that's fantastic. Another one is when Chadwick Boseman is essentially cursing God because of all the issues that have happened in his life, all the racism that he's experienced, all the heartbreak. And it's just so sad. It's a difficult moment. And then another band member attacks him and says, no, not my God. That's my God. That's my God. And you can see how when tragedy strikes and for people who have experienced racism, this deep sadness, God, you know, how could you allow this to happen? Mm. But then you also see for many that there's this source of hope in the Christian gospel. And I think that scene is just, it's full of so much tension and it's so well acted. So, yeah, a lot of great scenes from this movie, even if overall, I didn't land in my top 10, just a lot of good stuff here.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the, that to me is a case of a film that has such incredible performances that are worth noting. It may not be in my top 10 films, but it is certainly, the performances in it are wild, especially Boseman, whether or not he had passed away. And that's always sort of the question in these things, right? Where you say, well, should they be nominated because he passed away? Like, I heard those things around Ledger at The Dark Knight. But I really think that whether or not he has passed, this is just a remarkable performance and remarkable moment.
Yeah, and, you know, if he hadn't have passed, would he be nominated? I don't know. Does he deserve to be? Yes. Because it's one of the better performances of the year. And so I'm fairly certain it will happen. And if he wins, I think it's going to be a really great moment. But yeah, good film. So my number one is a movie that you actually recommended to me. I'd been hearing people talk about Sound of Metal, and you came on the podcast and you said, hey, you got to check this out. And you mentioned to me some of the religious and even Christian influences within this movie. And I loved it. It made my number three of the year. For those who have not seen this film, it's directed by Darius Marder. And it stars a man named Ruben, played by Riz Ahmed. And he is a heavy metal drummer who suddenly loses most of his hearing, and he checks into a program, a religious program, a Christian program for deaf addicts. And at first he says, you know, I can't afford it. And the leader, a man named Joe, played by Paul, I think it's Rassi or Racky, hopefully I'm pronouncing it right. he tells him, you know, a church will sponsor you. And that's when Reuben says, well, I'm not really religious. And Joe says, no, they'll still sponsor you. It's a really fascinating depiction of the church. And I don't want to spoil this movie, but towards the end of the film, Riz Ahmed has a conversation with Joe. His character has a conversation with Joe. And Joe is talking to him about not just his physical issues, but his spiritual issues, the state of his soul. And he's encouraging him not to see his deafness as a disability, but really an opportunity for a new start. And he talks about the importance of stillness. And he says this. He says, the world does keep moving. This is a film about change. He says, the world does keep moving. And then he goes on, but for me, those moments of stillness, that place, that's the kingdom of God. And he's talking about resting in something greater than your abilities, your physical abilities, but tapping into something greater. And of course, for Joe, that is the person of Jesus. That is God. And religion has changed his life. It's a great moment. And that scene continues further, and Joe has to make a decision. And it's the right decision, but when it's done, the camera just kind of lingers on him, and he is on the verge of just kind of falling apart because it is so hard. It's a fantastic scene. I think it's the best scene of the year.
Yeah, it's a remarkable moment. And my number one of the year comes from Adam Sandler's Hubie Halloween. And
yep.
Oh wait, no, sorry, wrong list. No, no, I'm so thrilled that you saw the film and that moment hit home, because in truth, that moment is actually my number one moment of the year.
Sorry to steal your thunder and explain it before you had a chance to.
There is no thunder stolen, because I'm just thrilled that somebody's taken my advice and seen that film. That it is honestly one of these films, and I remember when I saw it, that moment resonated like somebody had beat a drum, frankly, because. And I think I said this when we spoke before, not only is it rare to ever hear a film reference the kingdom of God at all, It is even rarer to hear them reference the kingdom of God well. And this is one of those moments where it just talks about the spiritual change, the spiritual weight and significance of a moment of silence. And a moment of stillness where something new can be born. And it's completely unexpected in so many ways, because it's not like the film has, you know, diatribes about going to church or anything like that. Like you said, the most they reference is the fact that it's the building is sponsored by a church. Yeah. But this is a brief but powerful speech that resonates so loudly throughout the entire context of the film, that I honestly cannot celebrate this moment enough from this year, because I honestly agree with you fully. I think it is such a beautiful space. The film is wonderful. I think that both of them are incredible in the film. Their use of sound design in the film is just remarkable. But that moment, there is something so special about that moment that it absolutely is my number one for 2020.
I'm glad that we, you know, there's this consensus about it. But it's fantastic. A couple other great scenes there. I don't know if you like the movie Palm Springs with Andy Samberg. At the beginning of the movie, he does this like dance because he's lived the day so many times. He kind of knows where everybody in the dance floor is going to be. I think that's a really great scene. Another scene would be in Seoul. when 22 kind of catches that leaf in her hand, and there are really some great scenes. It's hard to boil it down to three because we got some good scenes this year.
Oh yeah, there really is true. Palm Springs, believe it or not, just made it up here, north of the border. Just made it up here on Amazon because we don't have Hulu.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it just appeared on Amazon last week or 2 weeks ago. And it is, so it's on my list. I love the scene in Seoul with the barber shop. That to me is great. Or I do like the drunken dinner party in Mank.
I did not.
That's fair. Or the slanderous argument that takes place in Boys State. Where there's this moment where they start arguing over policy, and to hear these 16, 17 year old boys are like, and of course, I mean, let's say it. The mirrored highway scene in Tenet is a great scene to watch.
It's great. Yeah. No, it's great. Yeah. Well, this is a lot of fun. I've never done the best scenes list before, and so this is kind of cool to think through some of my favorite scenes. A little bit different than the top 10. I enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm glad, Wade, because yeah, I think there's something different about reflecting on it in this way as opposed to the whole film, which so many of us do. But let's talk about a film here for a moment. Let's come back to the film that actually has brought us here together today. Let's talk about Midnight Sky. released on Netflix and directed by George Clooney. Midnight Sky tells the story of a lone scientist named Augustine in the Arctic who races to contact a crew of astronauts returning home in the midst of a mysterious global catastrophe. The film stars Clooney and Felicity Jones. Kyle Chandler is in it as well. It was originally supposed to, it was actually filmed mostly with IMAX cameras and was one of those films that was finished before the pandemic and supposed to be released in theaters, but went straight to Netflix. And as always, a reminder, this film is rated S for spoilers, but I would love to know, Wade, what you think of Midnight Sky.
Well, you know, before I saw the film, you asked me if I could come on and talk about it. Very much looking forward to the movie. Sadly, did not like it very much. It felt like a film that lasted all of 2020. I felt like I had watched it for 2 hours and then, oh no, I got another hour to go. I'm not really a big fan, and I feel like the biggest problem with this movie is that you have two storylines that are happening at about the same time. You have George Clooney's character, and he's down on Earth, and something has happened. And essentially, everybody on Earth is probably going to die. And he's trying to warn a group of astronauts that are coming home. And so we have their story. It just feels like those narratives never sync up. And as a result, it's almost like whiplash as we go from one story to the next. So I thought the Sweet Caroline scene was good, but not really a fan of the film overall.
Oh man, maybe we should have talked about this before the movie moments to give us a boost at the end. I don't want to bring our people down. You know what? Honestly, I hear what you're saying. I think I liked it a little more than you. I was not in love with it, and I wouldn't have been in love with it had I seen it in theaters either. You know, I've heard that too. With some films, it feels like you need to see it in a theater to truly appreciate it. I hear what you're saying about the two storylines not quite syncing up. There were things I actually quite enjoyed about it. It didn't feel like the pieces fully came together, and there was a number of things they borrowed from other films. But every film does do that. But I agree with you that it does feel long, and it is quite slow, especially at the beginning of the film. Now, having said that, you know, in some ways, I felt like this particular film, and I mean, I should say, before I say this, it is fascinating to me how everything gets read. Our circumstances often get read into the films that are produced because they come out or go into production well before events that take place. Like, I remember when the Lego Batman movie came out, people started reading the beginning of the Trump era into this film because they were talking about, you know, excess and how it affects you. And, like, the film had been in production for 4 years, but that's where people were. Midnight Sky was finished filming in February, a full month before the world shut down. But I do feel like there's something significant to the themes they're trying to get at in this film that do make it feel relevant, even though the film is far from perfect. Go ahead.
There definitely is a relevance to it. Yeah.
Like, there's so much there between the distance of people. Even the fact that the world has been ravaged by a pandemic, which they never name, this idea of starting over, I think there's some significant aspects of it that seem to land in a year that is asking those sorts of questions. And for that reason, I wish it did it more effectively, but I do think that there was something to it that gives it some relevance that props it up a bit for me in this particular year.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I think the beginning of the film was a bit slower.
Yeah.
But I probably like the beginning the best because it does concentrate on George Clooney's character. It's a little muddled because you get his character and then we have a flashback to everyone kind of leaving the base. And then we get another flashback to his character when he was younger, and then we go to a dream sequence on the spaceship, and then we go to what's actually happening on the spaceship, and it's kind of a lot happening. I enjoyed Augustine's story and hearing from him, and I would have loved to dig into that a little bit more because there's definitely a reason why he's doing what he's doing. The film is concerned with him at the beginning. And then he's almost gone for what feels like most of the second half of the movie. And we go to the astronauts, which feels like a different film altogether. But I never really felt like their characters were kind of fleshed out. And I would have liked to maybe stick with Clooney, give him a little more to do. Let's hear more about his backstory so that the sacrifices he's making or the discomfort he's experiencing has some more heft or weight to it. Also, too, I don't try to guess movies. I just don't like doing that. I like figuring out what a movie's trying to do, but in terms of guessing its ending or a twist, it just seems to take the fun out of it. I felt like this movie, which has two twists at the very end that are kind of connected to each other, I felt like this movie telegraphed at least one of those from the very beginning, which just hurt the overall, I think, structure and make of the movie.
Yeah, that, you know what, I think that's absolutely fair. And I mean, so much of the first half of the film is focused on his relationship with the girl, with the young girl that he's with, her Iris, I believe her name is. And they try and build and root the film in that. And actually, one of the things I learned when I was prepping for this podcast, they filmed during the storm scene. They actually did film during a ridiculous storm. It was 40 degrees Fahrenheit below zero.
Whoa.
with 50 mile an hour winds in a blizzard for that scene. And it's a blip in the story. Mm-hmm. Like, there are some very intense and powerful moments in that journey, but because this is why I think it doesn't quite come together, because they have two stories that could be well told, but they both suffer because of the nature of everything sort of having to be thrown together. Like, you're right. Like, all of a sudden, the second half of In Space, and with a crew that we don't really get to know. We sort of get to know a few of the characters, and certainly with the lead couple up there. But, you know, there's the scene that I talked about where they're actually outside on the outside of the ship, and a character, they're struck by an asteroid field, and a character goes into there's a really tense scene where a character dies within the film. But I didn't, I sort of went, I didn't know she was on the ship. Because it was such a blip. And I think that there are two interesting movies that collide, but the pieces don't fully match up. And I think that's why it suffers.
I definitely feel that same way. And I want to know more about Clooney's character. I want him to open up. He's playing a stoic individual, but you know, we do need a little bit more from him. I do appreciate some of the ideas, some of the themes in terms of survival and meaning within life. And so there's the subplot, which involves Kyle Chandler, and he and the rest of the crew, they find out that the world is falling apart, and he hears a transmission from his family. It's a dated transmission, but they are going underground. And he has an opportunity to either turn back and to colonize space, and hopefully the human race will survive, or to go back to Earth. And him and another character choose to go back to Earth. And we don't actually – this spoiler, I guess, because we do have spoilers.
Spoilers in this one. It's fine.
Here. He chooses to go back. We don't actually see what happens. And I thought that scene was powerful because – For Chandler's character, life and survival is important, but it seems to be that survival without love and without doing everything you can to save those that you care for, it really is meaningless, or it is empty. And he sacrifices to do everything in his power to find his family. And I thought that some of those ideas were very, very good. Same thing too with Clooney and his character in terms of guilt and what drives him. And he is driven by some of the mistakes of his past. And if he can find a way to atone for those, then perhaps he might do some good. And so some of those driving forces behind these characters, I think work well, even if the story ultimately lets them down.
Yeah, I agree. And that scene with Kyle Chandler is actually really interesting. And Demian Bashir, you know, in their return to Earth, there's something there. This is what I mean. Like, I think that I wanted to spend more time with Kyle Chandler in that moment to sort of have that land better. I mean, I'm sure he just wanted to get back because it was Friday night and it was football season. But but no, there is something powerful about that moment. And you know, one of the things, you know, with what we were saying there, though, one of the things that I would say, Wade, as well, is there's the theme of connection is all through this film, not just how we maintain them, but how we receive them and how we keep them. So I was just wondering if there's anything there that you picked up on or connected with.
Yeah, and I think in terms of connection, the astronauts, their story seems a little bit bland. I think there are some connection points, but I think the most comes from some of the backstory we get with Clooney's character, in that he seems to be an individual who's completely driven by work to the point that he abandons his daughter. And when he's finally left alone, that's when he realizes, oh no, maybe there's something to this connection. Maybe there's something to this human connection in the world. And of course, he comes across Iris, and that plays out as a visible longing of this internal yearning for connection and human connection. And it says something about, I think, as human beings, whether we can live so much of our lives in just surviving, so much of our lives feeling like we're dedicated to this particular work and shut everything out and devote ourselves to a career, or devote ourselves to this or that. But ultimately, those things, they don't fill those needs for connection and for community within us. So I think those are some important points that the movie at least alludes to.
One of the things that really struck me about the idea of connection is those who were on the mission. Because so many of the moments that we do have with them that I love are these interesting relational touch points that they have carried with them. You know, the idea that the idea that their memories are essentially on tape, which is almost Star Trek-y in a way, you know, like they're sitting in one scene. There's the one character is sitting in her mom's living room digitally. And Kyle Chandler is having breakfast with his kids digitally. Yeah. It's not happening live. It's their programmed memory of it. And I think that was so fascinating. You know, again, this to me struck me in a COVID pandemic world. Or what are the things that we bring with us in times of isolation? And here are these people that are completely isolated in space, recreating the moments that they remember the best that they can digitally. And I think that's why I love the Sweet Caroline moment so well, or so much. First of all, it's really the only moment of fun within the movie. Like, if you're not firing a gun into a blizzard to try and shoot down wolves or getting destroyed out in outer space, there's this one moment in the middle of it. But this idea that this song, this silly, ridiculous, nonsensical song can enliven all the people there, even the people that there's, and one character says, look, I don't know this song. I don't know this song. I still don't know it. But in the chorus, you know, they all start joining in and I'm overthinking it here, but we talked about before, hands touching this is a song that is about connection in a weird way, and in this context it changes it a little bit broader sense, and I thought that was really interesting, especially in light of our current situation.
I think it was too, and I love that you point out those scenes. I think visually those scenes where they're in their homes or they're eating breakfast with their family, I think those are nicely done too. And if we're looking at little glimpses throughout this film that I enjoy, and that's one of them. These characters, too, who also signed up for this trip thinking that they would be gone for X amount of time and slowly realizing, oh, that's probably not, you know, probably not going to happen. I thought that was good. And then too, you get some tense parts with George Clooney throughout the film, and when he does reach the crew and he is able to explain what happened, when those two storylines kind of come together, I think the film begins working a little bit better towards the end as well.
Yeah, I could, like I said, agreed. I it's far from perfect, but there are some things like that I find really fascinating and sort of appropriate. You know, given the way we've talked about the film, maybe it's not worth getting too much into this, but I thought there was an interesting conversation that Clooney has that might be worth discussing, at least briefly. When he's talking with Iris, at one point he just keeps repeating the fact, I am the wrong person. Which obviously, you know, as films go, we know that he's reading into it. So I was just wondering what you think that truly means, and whether or not what it means to be the right person in those in those moments.
Yeah, and I think it kind of goes back to the theme of guilt, in that he's slowly realized what he has thrown away. That at the end of his life, he realizes that everything could have been different. And even though the world's ending, he could have had X amount of years loving others and being loved by others. So I think it involves it involves the weight that he carries. And two, we see this journey as a way to work off some of that guilt, in a sense. And we see his mental state projecting an individual in order to make sense of that guilt. So he's definitely carrying that weight and not really sure how to handle it and hoping for some sort of peace. And I wish the end would have helped out a little bit more. Yeah. And we get the twist. And of course, oh, okay, yeah, wow. But is there a way when he or a moment when he finds grace, the idea that he is forgiven, the guilt has been dispensed, and it's not because he made it to this spot and warned the astronauts, but because forgiveness was freely offered. I wanted to see some more of that to kind of complete his story. But definitely these ideas and these themes are there.
Yeah, and you know what? I agree with you in that, because I feel like this film, again, as we've both said, there were the makings of two really solid films. And they both almost cancel each other out. You're right, there's this guilt, there's this shame, and certainly this idea of his trying to remedy that. And, you know, thinking about this, we talk about the two twists at the finale. If they had even only had one of the two, pick one, it might have landed better than both. Yes. And I know the conversation about his motivation, about why I've heard an argument, and I'm not sure, to me it was unclear in the film, but I hear an argument that one of the reasons that he fought so hard to get to the station and radio the ship is because he knew who the captain was.
Okay.
I actually appreciate the film less if that's the case.
Yeah.
Because that, to me, it still builds into the selfish motivation. Like, to me, if he's truly doing it to say, this is the last ship, like, he's looking at the list and all of them are gone except this one ship. That's why, to me, it's unclear. I think, you know, there's something really powerful there. In terms of a redemptive arc of, I was selfish and now I see, like, we have to do something for everyone, not just this one person. But, you know, one of the things I think about it, you know, when he talks about being the wrong person, I also toyed with the idea that being the right person doesn't necessarily mean that you know you're the right person. You might be the right person and not actually know you are or feel like you should be. Because if you look at his story arc, here's somebody, like, he's riddled with guilt and shame. But when you look at it at the end of the film, who else is more qualified to make this run, to make this call, but one of the people that helped set this up in the first place and understood this and said, we were wrong? And I think at one point, actually, a character even says it might be him. I think it is actually Clooney that says, all we know about what happened is that it's our fault. And so just trying to say to these people, start over. But he is the one that should know that. But he doesn't feel like he should be. You know what I mean? And I think, to me, that's an interesting shade of a conversation of being the right person without knowing that you are.
And there's this sense of humility there.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I don't, you know, we don't know what happened, but we know who did it. And so there definitely seems to be a change of heart too for Clooney's character.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just wish they had been able to orchestrate it better.
No, it's a missed opportunity, and it stung too, because I was very excited about this film, and I like these types of movies. It's kind of apocalyptic stories that involve space. It's a lot of fun.
Well, and I mean, he keeps going back to space, so they're not all going to be gravity. Sometimes they're going to be Solaris, so that's okay. but yeah, certainly. Wade, we've sort of shared our thoughts on this film. We should probably screen it or skip it. Midnight Sky, screen it or skip it.
Yeah, you know, we talked about some of the better qualities of the movie, but I would say skip it and maybe choose a movie that we talked about earlier with some of our favorite moments and watch that instead.
Oh, man, if that's the standard now, then it's...
No. I'll just add that. But yeah, no, skip it either way.
I'll be a little more generous to it. I think I enjoyed it a little more. I think the fact that it's a streaming film means it's a little easier to pop in and feel like, you know what, okay, that's what it was. I don't think it's a must see. And if it were in theater and we were paying our 10 or 12 bucks for a screening, I would definitely be saying skip it. But I'm going to give it a lukewarm stream it. On this sense, okay. not out of deep love and passion, but there were enough seeds there that I thought, sure, it's Saturday night and you're finished watching Bridgerton. What else are you going to watch? Wade, thank you so much for coming on. I love it every time you come on, but this especially was fun. So thank you so much.
Yeah, no, I had a great time. I always appreciate talking to you, Steve, whether it is on Seeing and Believing or it's over on Screamfish. I enjoy it and always have a lot of fun. And you tell me about stuff from Canada I didn't know about, and that just makes it all the better.
Well, in 2021 could be that year that you watched The Littlest Hobo, so that's fine.
I have thought about that television show every day since you told me about it. I've watched a couple of clips, and it really is something. It's not good.
Oh no,
but it's something.
No, it's not good, but it is. That's actually the tagline for this film too. I think actually for Midnight Sky, it's not good, but it's something.
It's something.
Wade, why don't tell us what you're up to? Why don't you you pump your stuff here?
Yeah, so I'm not actually active on Twitter, but I guess you could follow me maybe on Instagram. I feel like that's the platform that I have the most fun with. My tag or my username is Wade Hance, Wade and Hance. So I post about stuff on there, and sometimes I'll talk about movies, just depending on how much time I have. But I would encourage listeners, after you're done listening to Screamfish, if you want to check out our podcast, Seeing and Believing, my co-host, Kevin McLenathan, and I, we talk about films from a Christian perspective every single week and always have a lot of fun. And that can be found on ChristInPopCulture.com or just on iTunes, searching Seeing and Believing.
Yeah, it's a great show. How many episodes are you guys at now? Do you have any idea? Because you guys have been at it for some time.
Yeah, so we just recorded, it just went live, too, by the time that this goes live, episode 276.
Oh,
it's,
my
it's
word.
Really nuts.
That's insane. Well, you guys have been weekly now for, I guess it's been the better part of 5 years or so.
So we are coming up on 6 years here next month.
Wow.
Crazy.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's huge.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun, and you know, it's fun to talk to someone about movies every single week. It really is. You know, you love movies, and you have that. It's like that time in your schedule every week. We're like, okay, we're gonna record a podcast, talk about movies. It's great.
Yeah, it's great, and you guys have a great rapport. So, I it's a great show, and I really appreciate you taking the time to pop on to Screenfish and chatting with us this week. So thank you so much, man. Always fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate it, and excited about doing it again.
Absolutely. And for you at home, a reminder that You can find us wherever podcasts are available. And if you go to the screenfish.net podcast page, you can download Fishing for More, which includes small group questions if you decide to subject yourself to Midnight Sky. partake and enjoy Midnight Sky together. You can have those conversations as well, probably over Zoom, let's be serious, but certainly with others.
Yeah, no, definitely right now over Zoom, just for safety's sake.
That's right. You can have a Netflix party with this one. With a lot of wine. No, I'm kidding.
or apple juice.
Or apple juice. That's right. Absolutely. That's right. We will be back next week as we talk about another cinematic classic, Wonder Woman 1984, which will be a lot of fun to talk about. Mm-hmm. But we are so thankful that Wade could join us this week, and we hope that you will come back next week to tune in as with SF Radio. And as always, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.